Lea Delaria is known as Big Boo on Orange is the New Black, a comedian, singer, and gay icon who combines side-splitting comedy with a velvety jazz voice and sassy stage presence, mingling choice jazz standards and even covers of classic David Bowie tunes. Her new show is called Oh F*** It's Christmas, that she'll be bringing to the Fisher Center at Bard on December 8th at 7:30.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the land, so is listening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland.
It is a great pleasure to welcome Lea Delaria to the program and to talk about how Oh F*** It's Christmas came about.
So I think it probably started more as an adult, you know, and having to deal with the sort of craziness that the holiday has turned into.
When you think about that craziness and you put the show, give us a sense of the arc of a show that is Oh F*** It's Christmas, because you are known, of course, for doing both stand-up comedy as well as the integration of the music as well.
Yes. Well, that's what's going to happen. You're going to get your basically a Delaria show, and anybody who's ever seen me perform knows what that is. So you're going to get a mixture of jazz and stand-up, and that's basically what this show is going to be. There is a little extra sketch stuff that I'm doing in this show, and it's just literally all wrapped around, you know, a collective, oh, my God, now we have to shop, now we have to buy things. You know what I mean? It's like the shared experience that we have around the holidays. And I think we've got that extra added Trump thing that I will also be talking about. It's a crazy raucous show, not for the faint of heart. Come laugh. You're going to laugh a lot, and you're going to enjoy some ridiculously great jazz musicians, because I'm bringing my girls with me. And, you know, we're going to have a good time. Everything I'm known for is going to be, I'm throwing it all in this show.
The ensemble you have is incredible. Amazing musicians. And give us a sense of how long you've been together, how you brought them all together to be your group.
Well, what happened was I, you know, suddenly found myself after years of just getting by, paying my rent, you know, living what I call a very charmed life. You know, I've never had a day job. I've only done what I do. And after years of doing that, I suddenly found myself in a position where I was ridiculously world famous and had all, you know, I had, let me just put, how shall I put this? You know, if you look like me and you talk like me and you ran out to give before you were 20, you know what I mean? The world is not standing online to hand you a whole lot of money. It's just not. So, suddenly I found myself with this money, and I thought, you know, I'm a big feminist. Why don't I put my money where my mouth is and hire a beautiful band of female musicians that are unbelievable, who I know them all. Why don't I just bring them all together? So I did that a little over a year ago, and we have been touring the world, having the time of our lives ever since.
Now, about the money. So this comes this comes out of Orange is the New Black, which if so, were you just stunned by the power of television, of what that could do for a career?
Well, what it was, it's not just television, because I had the power of television on my side. Yeah, I've been on American television since 1993.
Sure.
Pretty regularly. I mean, you turn on your TV and see me on everything. It wasn't that. It was the power of streaming television. It was the power of Netflix, and the fact that over 100 million people in over 190 countries were all tuning on their television at the same time to watch me and my show. You know what I mean? That was something we had never experienced before. And those of us who were on the show that were kind of old show hosts, like me and Kate Mulgrew and Laura Prepon and Natasha Lyonne, we saw the difference like immediately. And honestly, when the first season dropped in 2013, within 24 hours, I couldn't go anywhere without people screaming when they saw me. And that was like, that is indicative of what my life has been ever since.
By the way,
I'm a Jonas Brother. I'm suddenly a rock star. No clue how it happened, because, you know, came out of nowhere, even though I have been spending my entire life with a lot of people knowing who I am and asking for my autograph. It's completely different now. Everybody carries a camera with them. Everybody's a paparazzi. Everybody wants a picture. Everybody wants to talk to you. You know what I mean?
By the way, who needs the Jonas Brothers if you and Kate Mulgrew can be the show hoes? I mean, that's...
That was very funny.
That's money in the bank, as far as I'm concerned.
Me too, honey.
Now...
So let me tell you something. When you come to acting through stand-up comedy, which is what I've done, it's frightening when you have to stand toe-to-toe with Kate Mulgrew in a scene.
No, it's a formidable presence, no doubt.
Absolutely.
So... But, oh, by the way, let us not forget the fact it's a great show.
It is.
I mean,
it's an incredibly well-written show and, you know, and a cast of, I think, just giants. And, you know, it's really interesting because many of these people in our show who other like myself and people go, wow, how did these, you know, where did you find these shows? We're all New York theater actors. Every single one of us.
Right.
So, I mean, and have been doing it a long time. Annie Golden has been on stage a long, long time. You know what I mean? And is incredibly famous here in New York. Every this entire cast, if you can go through one by one, and they are all New York theater greats. And it's really, you know, it's really great that they finally got the due, you know what I mean, that they should have gotten. These fabulous women. I mean, it's a really interesting industry, and the streaming has really changed everything for actors. So it's just fascinating to have this incredible showrunner, incredible actors, incredible writers. It's been a gift. It's been a dream for me to be on this show.
So as it wraps up, do you look at that longingly and say, oh, I wish I could do this more often? Or do you think to yourself, yeah, now's a good time to probably go?
Yeah. I think we're all on the same page that now is probably a good time to go. You know what I mean? It's not the bright, shiny penny that it used to be. And we all do other things. And I know Taylor Schilling is really looking forward to getting back on stage, like acting in the theater.
Sure.
And Natasha has her own show on Netflix now. And, you know, writers have gone off and done their other things. It has given me so much more clout in the industry, and also where work is concerned. I mean, it's been an incredible gift, and I'm looking forward to the next chapter.
And not
what's going to happen next for me? I never know. I think my career has been surprising to anybody who has followed it over the course of time. You know, so I have no clue what's next for me. You know, I know I'm going to do some touring, and I got some filming, and there's some Broadway stuff in my back pocket right now. So it's like, it's going to be an interesting, the next year is going to be very interesting for me.
Now, let me ask you, because you mentioned this a moment ago when we were talking about the show. So the show that you're doing at the Bard Fisher Center, and you said there's going to be some Trump stuff in there. Now, what I have seen, right, of course. So what I have seen with comedians and with, I mean, even people in my profession, is that even though it's the thing that we all seem to want to get away with and stop talking about, yet we can't, and we also, deep down, when I assume that that's well-received material in the sense that people want that to be mocked.
Well, let me put it this way. I get walkouts.
Really?
There are people there that walk. I'm always shocked when it happens because I'm like, you know, it's not really hard to know who I am.
Well, I was going to ask.
Anybody who follows me on Instagram knows I do Trump Friday every Friday.
I would think your demographic would lean more left, let's say, than red state
Absolutely.
Trump America. Yeah.
Absolutely. But there is a liberal horde out there that thinks we're supposed to embrace trying to understand what people are and trying to, you know, to heal the country. That's just not me. You know, and I think some of those people I might be a little too radical for. And I think that's part of what's going on in my audience, if you know what I mean, even in this day and age. And I find it difficult to shut up when I see a tyrant. It's the same time, you know, I'm sorry. The man calls himself a nationalist and is sending troops to the border. That's, you know, page 125 out of the Mussolini handbook. You know, we need to start stepping up here.
So there's the million-dollar question. Why aren't people stepping up? I mean, I of course people are going to say, well, they are, and they're doing all of these things. But you would think that just everybody would sort of universally say, no, we can't do this.
Yeah. Well, I think we're now heading in that direction. I think after the last couple weeks, from pipe bombs to shootings in synagogues to troops being sent to the border, these are heinous. I know that when more of us go to the polls, Democrats win. I think that given what this stuff that has happened, there's a lot of people stepping up. You know, and some of us have always been stepping up. I look at Michael Rappaport and I look at Robert De Niro and myself. I mean, there's been a lot of us Trump people out there. So I think there's a lot more people that are less inclined to be tolerant and more inclined to be rageful after the Kavanaugh hearings. I mean, it's a litany. It just goes on and on and on.
Right.
From the beginning of his presidency until now.
Now, I have talked to people not all that long ago who are certainly on your side ideologically, and yet say, well, yes, but we can't be overly surprised given the climate that people often see in this country. For you and someone who has been very out.
What climate is that?
Well, in the sense of a racist climate, an anti-Semitic climate, anti-gay climate. I mean, the way I've heard it described is that, you know, are we seeing the worst of our country, or what we have had when we've had the best of our country is just a veneer that is suppressing that rage and hate?
Interesting. Well, what I think is, and I'm going to just say this straight out, this is a result of apathy. What's happening is a result of apathy. It's a result of right-thinking individuals who got sleepy during the Obama administration because we thought we'd done it. And what we are seeing now is the backlash of that. It's the pendulum swinging in the other direction. It's also, as I've said to people many times, as you gain your rights, as you gain your freedom, that's when they start fighting harder against you, which is what happened. They are terrified of us. They are so terrified of losing their status. You know, I've said this, I say this more times. I can't even tell you how many times I said this in interview. Equal rights is equal rights. It doesn't mean special rights for anyone else. And it's not taking any of your rights away. It's not a pie. It's not a pie where we divide the pieces around. It is what it is. And these men of power, these cis straight white guys of money, are terrified about seeing their clout dissipate during the course of those of us who have been disenfranchised gaining what is most rightfully ours. So this is something that that is going to continue. This is a battle, and the apathy of my side needs to end now. People who are saying, "Why vote?" That's what the Republicans are saying. That's what they want you to think, so that you don't go to the polls. Why vote? It doesn't matter. Your vote won't count. Of course your vote counts. It is not only a right, it is a privilege. And when people say to me, it's not a privilege, it's a right. No, it's a privilege. Because let me point to you to hundreds of countries in our world, on our planet, who do not allow their citizens to vote. You should, shame on you for not exercising your right and privilege as a citizen. It's the very least and the very most you can do.
Back to your litany for a moment, which another thing. No. Another thing on the litany, though, is to add to the litany, and obviously it's already been there, but this idea that you can just, well, take the trans definition out of the dictionary and then it goes away.
Unbelievable. Yeah. See, that's what I'm saying. It's just been every day. And that, I think, is indicative of their fear. This, again, out of Mussolini's handbook, page 125. I don't think it's any accident that all these things happened from his administration. Taking the trans definition out of the dictionary, suddenly pipe bombed, troops to the border, especially troops to the border, right? This is him flexing his muscle before the election, trying to frighten people from voting. That is what fascists do. That is what tyrants do. They've done it since the beginning of time, and he's doing it now. All the more reason for our entire trans community to vote.
Now, I certainly agree with you on every step of the way, but this is rhetoric that we've heard from him, certainly not just in these days leading up to the election. We've heard
right.
rhetoric like this from him since he, well before he even became a candidate for president. So,
yeah, but it's not just a rhetoric. He's actually taking action.
Exactly. That was
yeah.
my point.
Before, he wasn't taking action. He wasn't taking action on the wall. He wasn't taking. Now, suddenly, right before the vote, he sent 50,000 troops to the border. That's not an accident.
No, absolutely
not.
That's
strategically planned. Yeah.
But the reason I bring it up is because what I'm concerned about is people think that it's just sort of a ploy on the election and then nothing will happen. And yet still, let's use his comments about the trans community, that, you know, that's still going to be part of the, that will forever be one of the, one of his greatest hits that he brings out at the rallies.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, and I'm once again going to point to the Fascism Handbook to say what they do first is find people to blame everything that's bad on, right?
Right.
In this case, it's the trans community and immigrants and queer people. We're the problem. We're the reason that the economy isn't good. We're the reason that you don't have a job. We're the reason. It's us, you know. In Nazi Germany, it was the Jews, and the Jews have been resoundingly spoken about. I mean, hello, he's got nothing but Nazi followers. I mean, if you go to any of his campaigns, you can see picture after picture after picture of these horrifying Nazis stormtrooping with their swastikas over their truck at their Trump rally.
Right.
You know, completely and utterly historical. You can look back throughout the course of the history of mankind and Western civilization. This is what they do.
When
it's all the more reason for us to be vigilant and out there, my friend.
Now, the question I started asking you was before we got into Trump, but the fact is that as you integrate this into your act, sure, you have some people that may get their feathers ruffled and they'll leave, but most of the people are with you, and I assume that is a communal act, isn't it?
Screaming in the show that I'm currently doing, that you guys aren't going to see because you're getting the Christmas show, but in the show that I'm currently doing, I generally receive 4 standing ovations during the course of the show. And the first one comes when I utter the word Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I get a standing ovation. I mean, I have to wait a really long time for that. And then I get another standing ovation at the end of my, you know, tirade about the current administration, which is really funny. And I've been very serious with you today. You're getting all the intellectual, yeah, none of the jokes. This audience, it's cathartic for people. When I do Trump Fridays on Fridays, it's cathartic. What the people that, if you read the comments are 95% people who are like, this is why I love you. Thank you for this. Someone needs to be saying this. Blah, 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 blah. It's all that. And then the other 5% are, you know, amalgamisms. They're Republican gray-faced robots. And a very occasionally an actual Nazi, a real person.
Oh, right.
But mostly, yeah, that's what it is.
And oh, by the way, your voice is beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
And was that, when did that come into your, meaning, was that the original goal? Was that the original?
Well, that was the first thing I ever did. My father was a jazz pianist, so I used to sing with him in the nightclubs at East St. Louis in St. Louis. So that was the first thing I ever did in front of an audience. I don't know if I think my goal started when I became a stand-up comic in San Francisco in 1982. So that's when I had things to say. And, you know, I was, you know, we have to hear the year, 1982, San Francisco, and where I was, San Francisco. So I sat helplessly and watched many of my friends die, just die around me while nothing was happening
yeah.
in a government that was apathetic. And I think that that's where the actual rage, like the real rage, was born inside me, that someone needs to speak up about this.
And you were speaking up at that time as it was happening.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of, I think that's where it's come, that's where my thing has come from. So you have, what I say to people, because sometimes people will say to me, don't you, if you were just a little nicer about it, if you weren't, you know, a little less rageful, blah, 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 blah. Well, the first thing I generally say is, you're a sexist. Don't pull any punches on that. You wouldn't say that to a man, period. You say that to women because women aren't supposed to be in touch with their rage.
Although I have.
One, that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, look, I've earned my rage. This is, you know, this is where I've come from. I've sat in a society while that just sits there while my people are murdered and die around me, and no one's saying anything or doing anything about it. It's inhumane. It's not what we, this is not what a civilized society should be. So that's kind of, that's where my thing comes from. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense. Although I've heard even male comedians say that, I think it was George Carlin who said there is a fine line between rage and comedy.
Absolutely, but George was lovely and very lovingly in touch with his rage when he needed it.
Yeah,
you know, and frankly, he's one of my heroes. But I have a little bit more to be rageful than straight white George Carlin.
Of course, absolutely.
You know, the straight white male George Carlin. So, you know, and he is, again, he's one of my heroes, absolutely one of my heroes.
Right.
But what I found was being in touch with my rage, so heavily being in touch with my rage, having that being so much of my comedy, I mean, like, it's really in your face, it's loud, it's constant. When I started doing stand-up, I found that people could only take that for about 5 minutes, and they were like, Mommy, make this stop. You know, it was just too much. It wasn't the gentle comedy of George Carlin, yeah, where you get a respite between laughs.
You don't want to...
Boom, 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 boom. So I instituted music into my comedy. That gave people this false sense of security while I sang them, you know, a little jazz standard. And then I'd start screaming and diking them again.
So it was an opportunity for you just to stop scaring them for a few moments.
Exactly. But it worked. And I thought, I mean, I started doing that in 82. By the end of 82, I was doing that. And that's what I've done ever since. So, you know, anybody who's ever seen me live has always seen me with at least one musician, usually three. And I'm always singing and I'm always doing stand up and it's in your face and it's wild. No Lily Tomlin eye, you know? Again, one of my heroes. I mean, no disrespect. You know,
understood.
It's just, I have a very, very distinct style.
The new show, Oh, It's Christmas. And you're going to bring it to the Fisher Center at Bard, and you'll complain about Christmas. You'll sing. It'll be a great show.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Don't forget the audience participation.
All right. Do we have to do anything? Do we have to practice? Do we need to do anything? Do we need to bring props?
No.
Okay. Just show up?
Just show up. I love my shows because I'm one of the few performers I know that if it's a 1,000-seat auditorium and 998 seats are sold, the two that aren't sold will be the ones right in front of me.
Yeah, I get that. It's December 8th. It's 7:30. It's at the Fisher Center at Bard. And Leah Delaria, what a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time. And have a lovely, lovely holiday season, as possible as that is.
Thanks, honey. See you at the show.
I look forward to it. Thank you. Again,
bye.
Leah Delaria's new show is Oh, It's Christmas. It takes place at the Fisher Center at Bard. You can find out more information by going to fishercenter.bard.edu. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight.